And welcome back to
Slasher Sisters.
I'm Alicia.
I'm Ryan.
And we're here to talk about some true crime, Christmas style, holiday edition. Well, actually, my case that I have for you guys today, like I said in the last episode, is pretty on theme. It happened on Christmas Day, but Ryan's story, however, may fall below the holiday, belt.
Maybe a little bit, yeah.
But I'm so excited to hear it anyway, and I'm sure you guys are too. So without further ado, let's let Ryan tell their story. I'm on it today, I know.
I'm proud. All right, so I'm like really reaching for this Christmas thing. So my Christmas connection, the reach is... The people I'm going to talk about today are called the Barbie and Ken Killer. You know, like, oh, kids get toys of Barbie and Ken sometimes on Christmas.
I have heard of it, but I've never, like, actually heard the story. So I'm really excited.
Okay, okay. So here's the ish. Here's what's going down. Do you get my Christmas connection?
Yes,
kids get toys. Yeah, they don't actually.
Do you want me to talk more about it?
No, like, I just wanted to make sure that you get it. Okay, so that's my Christmas.
Thank you for that Christmas special.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad you enjoyed it. All right, so first we're going to talk about Paul Bernard. He was born August 7th.
Is that Ken?
Yes, that is
okay.
Ken.
Cool. Just wanted to make sure.
You're like feeding into it too much now, and like,
can you shut up?
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so Paul is the Ken in this story, okay, I guess. Yep. Born August 7th in 1964 in Scarborough, Canada. I think I'm saying that right. His family was described as being pretty well off, and on the outside, they were like a decent-looking family, you know.
Well, obviously, if he looks like Ken.
Yeah, obviously. Totally.
They're a pretty family.
Oh, yeah, pretty family. So great. But, you know, behind closed doors, Paul's father was a really gross man who he went to jail for molesting a young girl, and it was said that he had also molested Paul's sister.
No!
He is,
so
yeah.
Sad.
Not a good dude. He's awful, but he's in jail.
Good.
Yeah. And it was also said that he had abused Paul's mother. And so when he went to jail, she got into this like really deep depression. And so she moved all of her stuff into the basement of their home and just kind of hung out there. Not sure really why she did that. I don't know if it was maybe just to like get out of like the bedroom that maybe she shared with her husband. Like different scenery or something. I don't know, but she did that for some reason. But even though all of this was going on, people didn't really think that it affected Paul much because everyone said that he was like this really happy kid. He did Boy Scouts. He was well-mannered. Like he never like acted up even when this happened or anything. And that could even be like maybe he was internalizing something like because of this. I don't know. Could have been anything like that. But he was basically like this perfect child. And then when he was 16... his mother told him a secret that she'd been keeping from him. Paul's father was not his actual father. Yep. So Paul was really upset with his mother and really disgusted with her. And he ended up having like no respect for her because of that. But I mean, like, I would be kind of happy if like my father was a scumbag that like molested people. And then right. I found out he wasn't my father.
Like you find out that like the monster you've been living with isn't related to you by blood. Like, thank you. I'd be.
Right. I'd be pretty happy. And yeah. If he was abusing my mother, I wouldn't be surprised that she had an affair.
Right. Yeah.
It was kind of like, I don't know, but difference in reactions there, I guess. But he was like awful to his mother after this. Their relationship totally changed. He would insult her all the time. He would just be like really nasty to her. Like
not standing Ken. Right?
Yeah, no. You won't.
Yeah, you're right.
You shouldn't. But
I guess the way you said it, like the Barbie and Ken killers. Yeah.
Yeah, no. Okay. So also around this time, he kind of developed a very like charming facade. but he also developed really like dark sexual fantasies.
Oh.
Yeah. So bad stuff. Bad stuff. He like would beat all of the women he dated, and he was really good at attracting women in a way that he was like because of his charming facade. So, you know, but he would beat every woman that he was with. He would like insult them, berate them, and he would like publicly humiliate them anytime that he could. It was like he got off on it or something. It was just something with empower, like that would power him.
Right.
It gross. Didn't like it. And then in May of 1987, Scarborough, the place where he lived, it was like plagued with a lot of crime. So a bunch of stuff was happening. But so a young woman was riding on the bus. She was on her way to her parents' house. And then she was attacked as she was getting off the bus, and she was brutally raped. And this was the first of three in 1 week. All of the women were between 15 and 21. And the attacks included like beating, verbal abuse, and sexual assault. And all of these ladies, like, they weren't killed or anything, so they did get away, which is good. But they all went to the police, and the police concluded that they were all done by the same person. And this person was dubbed the Scarborough Rapist, which, of course, was Paul. But the police didn't know that. Yeah. So he's already not a bad guy. Is a bad guy.
Right.
Yeah. Now we're going to introduce.
Barbie!
Barbie. We got Barbie. So this is Carla Homika, I think is her last name. We're just going to call her Carla. So Carla, she was born in May 4th, 1970 in Canada, was a normal child kind of until her teen years. So she was really pretty. She was smart. She was perfect. Like, that's why she was Barbie. They were also both blonde. So she loved animals, and she worked at a vet's office. This was around when she was like 17. So she also ended up going to this like pet convention, and this is where she meets Paul. Paul is 23 at this time. She's 17.
Oh.
Yeah.
Illegal. Oh, wait. Are they in Canada?
They are in Canada.
Do you know what? Is that? I don't know what that is in Canada, I guess.
I want to say it's the same as ours.
Let's just say it's 18, even though we don't know.
I think it is. I'm not totally sure, though. But either way, I guess by our standards, that's sketch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We think it is sketch.
So they instantly clicked, and they grew closer when Paul discovered that Carla had the same sick fantasies that he did.
So do you know what she looked like?
Yes. You could look up a picture and see what
like
she
Barbie
looked like.
And Ken?
She has blonde hair and blue eyes, I think. I don't remember what color her eyes were. But they looked like...
They pretty much looked like they would be dolls.
Kind of. They just kind of looked like your standard, like...
Pretty boy and pretty girl.
Yeah, with blonde hair, like... Okay, so they met. They're together, basically. So they quickly began this, like, sadist-masochist relationship because they were both really into that. The stuff that they were, like, really into wasn't... It was, like, I guess... I don't want to say worse, but it's, like... I don't know, like, more deadly. Just because, like, you can have a sadist and masochist relationship and it can be totally healthy. Like, and that sort of thing. But theirs is, like... It's just stuff that they do. It's, like, that's not what someone in the kink community would probably do.
Gotcha.
Like, you know. Yeah, so, and Paul was this, like, abusive master, and then Carla was, like, his willing slave
sort of thing. Or if you know from the thing, like,
mm-hmm.
So what would be something that you think would be unhealthy?
Unhealthy?
With that kink, yeah.
I would say...
Like, why do you say what you say about it, I guess?
Is because he is abusive to her, as in, it's, like... In the kink community, a lot of stuff is, like, it's consensual. And so, like, a lot of stuff that he'll do, like later in here, he, like, beats her with a flashlight.
And
she's got...
Consensual?
No.
Okay.
And he, like, that's, like, a regular thing. He had, like, given her, like, two really bad, like, black eyes she couldn't see. Like, it's just bad stuff. So it's, like, that kind of thing. But then it's also other stuff that they kind of, like, got off on is, like, not...
Like what?
Like, well, I'm going to get to that.
Oh, okay,
that's the
okay.
thing. But then it's like a healthy relationship. It's like you both have set your boundaries. Like, and there's that thing. It's like that's not a thing here. So, yeah. So while there's like in this relationship, Paul is still out like raping people. And she's encouraging it this entire time. She's like, full approval. You go do this. Like, see, that's part of their thing, too. They both enjoy that. So, yeah. So she's full encouragement. She wants him to go do this. And most of his victims, they were like ladies that were getting off the bus late at night or really early in the morning. And one was a 15-year-old girl that he had assaulted in her own room. So he would either like go on the bus or maybe he just like would follow people home or something. Like, yeah, not good stuff. And a couple of victims were able to fight him off, which is good. And he was even questioned by police twice, but they let him go. Because I guess he didn't seem suspicious or something. I don't know. But so from May to September of 1990, police had submitted more than 130 DNA samples for like suspect testing. They had received two leads that led to Paul. And for some reason, they just didn't think it was him because they didn't like take the lead seriously. So the first lead was given by a bank employee. There wasn't much detail about what this person had said, but I guess it just wasn't enough detail for them to believe that it was him. But then the second lead was from a wife of one of his friends. He had these three friends that were brothers, and one of their wives' name was Tina. And Tina had told the police that Paul, she had mentioned that he had recently been questioned, or he had been before questioned about being, you know, are you the rapist? That kind of thing. So there's that. He would also regularly discuss his twisted fantasies about rough, non-consensual sex with his friends. And she was convinced it was him, which, like, I don't know. I think that's something, you know, but they didn't believe her. Because of her speech impediment. So they didn't think that they could trust her word or take it seriously because she had a speech impediment.
That's bullshit.
Mm-hmm. And the girls who had this happen to them, they had, I think it's a sketch artist, the person who, the picture looked just like him.
Oh my God.
I know, like it's so similar. So that was another thing. But yeah, so they didn't take Tina's word. It was really dumb that they didn't do that. But they finally interviewed Paul. It lasted only 30 minutes. And he like willingly gave them DNA. And they had asked Paul why they think he was being questioned for all the rapes. And he said it was because he looked like this sketch. And apparently he was more credible than Tina. And they thought that she was just saying it to maybe get a reward or something, and they let him go. It's ridiculous. Like, this is crazy. So Paul and Carla become engaged. Carla would tell her friends that, like, she was super happy. Paul was amazing. Like, they were together for so long. It was so great. And 3 years into their relationship, Paul got bored with Carla and began to complain that she wasn't a virgin, and that bothered him, which is something you should never do. That is so shitty. That doesn't concern you at all.
But, like, hasn't he had sex with her?
Yep.
That makes no sense.
I want to say maybe he was saying that. It could have been that because I think he's crazy. But
it sounds pretty crazy.
Yeah. My first thought was maybe he was saying, like, maybe she had been with someone before him. Still has nothing to do with him. He doesn't need to worry about, like, that's not. But what you said, that's probably what it was. Just because she wasn't a virgin right then. And they have probably already had sex. So, I don't know. It doesn't make sense. So, Carla had a 15-year-old sister. And she kind of became subject to his, like, twisted fantasies. Carla still encouraged his fantasies, even when they were about her sister. And she tried to get Paul close to her, her 15-year-old sister. She's not a good person. So she would try, like, hanging around her sister a lot more. She would take her to parties, buy her beer, like, try and really get close to her. And Paul became like obsessed with her, and Carla would give him access to her room. Her name was Tammy, by the way, the sister's name. Okay. To Tammy's bedroom. He would go in, watch her sleep, masturbate while she slept. Sometimes he would look into her bedroom while she was changing. He was super creepy. He's disgusting. And Carla tells Paul that she wants to give him Tammy's virginity for Christmas.
Ew, it's not hers to give.
Exactly. It's disgusting. So December 23rd, 1990, Carla's parents are having this Christmas party. Of course, Carla gets invited. So does Paul. They have no idea that Paul is this like sick, nasty sleazebag. They love him. They think that he's so charming. And like, they have no idea what's about to happen, you know? Carla had gotten them horse tranquilizers from her job because she worked with animals, and she spiked her sister's drink with them. So at night, while everyone was asleep, Tammy was like, she was fucked up on horse tranquilizers, you know, drugged basically. And Carla holds a cloth covered in halothane over Tammy's mouth, and then she takes turns with Paul raping her sister. It's disgusting and horrible. And they videotape the whole thing.
Ew.
Yeah. So while all this is happening, Tammy begins to vomit. And she's, the way it sounds, she's vomiting in her like unconscious state. But she's on her back. So she starts choking on her vomit. And then Paul and Carla start to freak out. And so they try to hide any evidence of like them being there basically. And then they call the ambulance. And sadly, Tammy never regains consciousness and is presumed dead at the hospital.
Oh.
Yeah. So even though there's like an evident chemical burn on her face from the halothane that, you know, her sister held up against her, they didn't really say anything about it in there. And the drugs in her system apparently couldn't be detected. And her death was ruled an accident from her choking on her vomit due to alcohol poisoning. Which I think is dumb. It's horse tranquilizer. I feel like you could find that.
Yeah.
And because it was ruled an accident, there was no investigation done.
Damn.
Yeah. So then Carla befriends a 15-year-old that works at her job with her. In the summer of 1991, Carla invites her out for like a girls' night out. They go shopping, they get food, and then she takes her to her house. And she starts to give her a bunch of alcohol until she eventually passes out. And then Carla calls up Paul and tells him his surprise wedding gift is ready. They undress her and start videotaping her. She's passed out right now. She doesn't know what's happening. And then Carla begins to sexually assault her. And then later Paul joins in. And then the next morning, the girl wakes up. She's feeling really sick, but she just thinks it's because she had so much alcohol and she's got a hangover. She has no idea that anything happened. Yeah.
Poor baby.
And, like, Paul's not there. He's gone. So she doesn't even know that he was there. Paul is out just being a creep somewhere. Just gross. He runs into this 14-year-old girl who was locked outside of her home because she stayed out after curfew. Her name was Leslie. He approaches her, and then she asks him for cigarettes. He leads her to his car, telling her, you know, I've got cigarettes in there, blindfolds her, forces her into the car, and then takes her to his home. They start to do their thing to her, and while it's happening, he keeps telling her that she's doing such a great job, and if she continues to act the way that she is, like cooperating and things, for the next 2 hours, it will determine whether she lives or not. And obviously, she's going to try and save herself, so she's complying to everything that they're saying. And he told her that because she was blindfolded and couldn't identify them, if they let her go, then she'd have a better chance of being let go. But at some point, the blindfold does start to slip, so they don't let her go. They keep her overnight. And then Paul claims that Carla fed the girl a lethal dose of Hazen, I think is what it is. And they said that that's what killed her. But then Carla would later say, like, in court that it was because Paul had strangled her and that's what killed her. And a lot of times when they were, like, being questioned in court and stuff, they will pin it on each other so many times. Hmm. Like, I guess trying to get an easier off sentence for each other or something. But, like, yeah, they're not a very good team at the end. So yes, the girl, she dies, and then they stuff her body in the basement because the very next day, Carla's family is going to come over for dinner. So she has her family over for dinner, and they have a dead girl in the basement. Great. So after her family leaves, they decide the best way to get rid of her body is to dismember her and encase each piece in a cement block and then drop it in like a lake somewhere. So Paul goes out, he buys tons of bags of like cement that they can use at a hardware store, and he keeps the receipts, which later is used on him in court that he had bought all the cement, which good evidence. He also goes and gets his grandfather's circular saw to help dismember the body. And then together they take several trips down to a lake that's like 7 miles away from their home to drop individual blocks in the lake. One of the blocks ended up being 200 pounds. So I guess they couldn't lift it enough to get it in the lake. So they just left it on the side, which is so stupid. I don't get it. So in June 29th, 1991, they get married. And then the same day that they're getting married, a father and son go to the lake and discover the block containing human body parts. So they report it and an investigation is done. They find other, like all of the other cement blocks that were thrown in the water. And then April 16th, 1992, the couple was driving around a Catholic school looking for their next victim. They run into a 15-year-old Kristen French walking home. They pull into the parking of like a nearby church, and then Carla gets out of the car and she's pretending to be lost, and she's got like a map out, really trying to sell it. And she's asking Kristen for directions. And when Kristen tries to help her, Paul attacks her. Yeah. And then like shoves her in the front seat. Carla's like holding her hair back so that she can't move. And like Carla's in the back seat. But Kristen was a very like punctual girl and like on time and everything. So her parents waste no time in trying to like send out a search party, calling the police. They're really on it trying to save her. Or like they just know that something's wrong, basically. So police assemble a search party. They found several witnesses that had witnessed the kidnapping from like a bunch of different angles. Don't know why no one said anything if there was that many people. And one of her shoes was actually left in the parking lot. But even with all the witnesses, they were unable to identify Paul and Carla as the kidnappers. I know. So the couple ends up spending the entire weekend basically torturing this girl. They force feed her tons of alcohol. And then when the couple's done with her, they killed her. And then they went to Carla's family for an Easter dinner. 2 weeks later, the body was found in a ditch, like 20 miles away from the girl's high school. And she was like cleaned. Her hair was all cut off. People had thought that maybe they were like collecting their hair or something. But it was really just for some reason, Carla thought that it would like screw up in them trying to identify the body or something, which is so stupid. But yeah. Not the smartest crayon in the box. So Paul was always abusive towards Carla, and she eventually got tired of it, I guess. They've been married for like a hot minute though, or have been together for a hot minute. So, and this is where he viciously beats her with a flashlight. And so she's finally like, okay, I'm done. And they showed a picture in the thing that I was reading of like her after she got beat. It's like, it looks awful. Like, it looks so bad. Yeah. But so, yeah, she had really bad black eyes and everything. But she did end up leaving Paul. But then 2 months later, the DNA sample that Paul had given the police 26 months ago came back with a match. And he was put under surveillance for a few weeks, then arrested in February 1993. So Carla kind of realized, like, she hears that this happened. And then she's kind of realizing, oh, we're kind of like, I'm going to get caught too now since he's getting caught. And so she gets a lawyer, and then she sought out a plea bargain in exchange for testifying against her ex-husband. Or I guess husband. I don't know if they divorced or not, but they're not together, I guess. So she had claimed that he had attacked over 30 women and she was one of them. And she had said that he had abused her and manipulated her. And she was just like this little pawn in his game of like him doing all the stuff. Like she had no part in it. She didn't even want to do any of that stuff. And so the government had agreed a short 12-year sentence for Carla in exchange for her cooperation. But this backfired because Paul was like, no, she was very a part of this. I have video evidence of all of this stuff that happened. Yeah, really did backfire on her. So now then they end up both going to jail. But as it is right now, Carla has been released in 2005.
Oh, wow.
She's remarried and she has a family. She basically has this whole new life now. But I think she did get off easier because she, like, I think maybe because of the plea that she was trying to do, or maybe it was because he did more things. I don't know, but he's got life in prison, so he's never getting out.
Well, and not to excuse what she's done at all, because, mm-hmm. like, you know, no. But it sounds like he kind of had prior stuff.
No, he definitely did. He definitely did. But she didn't,
or mm-hmm. at least not that we know of. Yes. And so it does make you wonder if it was more of like a coercion thing or manipulation, or because she was so young, you know. Like,
that's true,
like,
yeah.
Was it really her fault when she was so young and they did it? I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. as you grow up, like, it's your responsibility to educate yourself and, like,
right, make yourself
better. But, you know, at still the age of, what was it, 17? 16?
17 is when they started dating.
That's still so young.
It is really young,
and
yeah.
you're still really impressionable at that age. So, I could see why maybe they would think of him as more of the, like,
that's true.
Super villain, and then mm-hmm. her as more of his, like, minor accomplice, because... Mm-hmm.
That's true. I understand that, yeah.
Yeah. Either way, though, they both sound like awful humans.
Yeah, yeah.
So is he still in jail?
Yes, he is. He is, like, for life.
Good.
He's in jail, yeah.
Good. I'm glad that that was what the courts decided.
Yes, me too.
Good things. All good things. What a great Christmas present to learn that he is still in jail.
Yes. Yeah, so that was Barbie and Ken.
Love that. And actually, as you were telling the story, I realized that I had heard the story before.
I thought you would have.
From, yeah, a true crime podcast that I can't remember the name, but like a year ago or something, I think, when I was like really into true crime podcasts, like when I first really got into it. And I remembered when you got to the sister part. Yeah. Because when you brought it up in my head, for some reason, I was like, something to do with the girl's sister, but maybe I'm thinking of a different case. And then when you got to it, I was like, oh, no, it is that case. Like, so sad.
Yeah.
But, yeah, when I remember first hearing about it, it was just like, oh, my gosh, that's terrible.
That sucks. Yeah. I can't imagine.
No, just, not at all. No. Like, literally, I can't even imagine. But my case is something that happened on Christmas Day.
Ooh.
In the 1800s. Late, I guess you would say. Okay. 1866. That would be late, right? Anything after 1850 would be, like, later, I suppose. And there's like a sick twist at the end that has to do with family. So like it kind of goes with what you did.
Oh, I'm excited. Yeah.
So, okay. A man named Charles Davis Lawson, who also went by Charlie, was born in 1866 in a community called Lawsonville, which was just down the road from Danbury, North Carolina. His parents, Augustus and Nancy, that's our mom's name. Oh, my God. Yeah. they had 11 children together, they were tobacco farmers who had their children help out around the farm. But when Charlie was 24, he met 19-year-old Fanny, and they got married a year later on March 12th of 1911. So the next year, they started adding children to the family, beginning with Marie, and then a year later, Arthur, then William, Carrie, and Maybelle. Okay, so this takes place in the 1900s. And now that I'm like, oh yeah, okay, so he was born in the late 1800s, but like it's taking place in the early 1900s, right. Just to clarify. Okay, so in 1918, they all moved to Germantown, where Charlie bought his first farm for $15,000. He got a loan for it, but when they all moved in, Charlie actually fell ill and he was bedridden. It turned out just to be arthritis, but like back then they didn't know that. So it was more of just like, you know, he can't work. He's in pain.
Right.
Okay. We don't know what this is. So this illness definitely took a toll on his body and he couldn't work for a very long time. This actually made them lose the farm because they were supposed to be paying back the loan and he wasn't able to. He was actually so sick that he couldn't even attend his own father's funeral after he died of pneumonia. He literally couldn't do anything. So after they lost their farm, they moved in with a family friend on their farm to work for them for a while to save up more money. In 1920, their little boy named William fell ill. At first it was just a cold, but then it got increasingly worse. He had a high fever, and Charlie decided now it was time to go find a doctor. And back then, you know, it took a while because he had to ride to town on a mule, get the doctor, ride back on the mule. And so once the doctor arrived, he diagnosed William with pneumonia, and just a short while later, he actually passed away at only 6 years old.
Aww.
After that, the family moved to a farm closer to where Charlie's brother's farm was, so that they could help each other out with the kids and whatnot. So the Lawson family ended up living on the McGee farm, and that is when two more children were born into the family of seven, who were James and Raymond. This was a time of hard work, but also happiness for the family. And then in 1927, after all of that hard work, Charlie finally got what he wanted, his own farm. It was located on Brook Cover Road, and it was 114 acres and had a house on it. But it was 100 years old, so they fixed it up, they started planting tobacco plants, and they began working. 2 years later, they had another child and named her Mary Lou, making them a family of 10. And although it's hard to provide for 10 people, they were doing all right. However, a neighbor noticed that the year prior, the kids hadn't gotten any Christmas presents, and they decided to ask Charlie if, like, they needed any help, and just told them, like, they were willing to help out with buying the kids Christmas presents, which is really, like, nice of them. Yeah, but Charlie said no, you know, out of pride, because he was like, you know, we'll do fine on our own. And he was like, we have, you know, the essentials. And he basically was like, no, we don't want your help. The neighbor just wanted to be friendly. So he went over to the house and decided to give Fanny a little snack with, like, fruit and candy inside. Or a little sack, sorry, not snack. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a snack, but a little sack with fruit and candy inside for her and the kids. While Charlie was out one day. And she was telling him, you know, it was just his pride that took over, and that's why he didn't want help from anybody. And she took the sack and told the neighbor Charlie was just too proud to admit that they were hurting for money, so they would rather just not celebrate. So 2 weeks before Christmas, Charlie told the family that they were going to head on a trip to Winston-Salem, and they were going to pick out a new pair of clothes and get a family portrait. It was a 45-minute ride, and Fanny wasn't too sure that they could afford all of this, but Charlie assured her that he had enough money, so they all went to a store and picked out very nice clothes. Then, they headed to the photography place, and they took a very nice photo. Then, they changed back into their regular clothes, and they decided to head on home. So a few days later, a neighbor passed away in the community, and there was a huge funeral held, and the Lawson family went. And they were all talking about death and, you know, that kind of thing, and Charlie just mentioned something along the lines of, he wouldn't mind dying, but he would want to take his family with him. Then it was Christmas Day of 1929, and Marie, their oldest daughter, was up really early making breakfast for the family of 10, as well as their nephew, Sanders, who was staying over, and Marie was also working on baking a Christmas cake and making them in separate pans to layer together, getting the icing ready. And the eldest son, Arthur, went with Sanders outside to do chores before they all came in to eat the breakfast that Marie had prepared. So after that, Arthur and Sanders went out to go rabbit hunting around 9 a.m., and they were only out for about an hour and a half before they ran out of ammunition and had to go back to the house to get some more. When they got there, they actually decided to have a shooting contest, and they set up cans to see who could hit the cans the most times, and Charlie the father joined in, you know, on the fun. So two of the younger girls, Carrie and Maybelle, said that later they wanted to head to Aunt Jenny and Uncle Elijah's house. So they were planning on doing that. They were getting all ready, and Marie was icing a cake while Fanny was getting Christmas dinner ready on the stove, and the little kids were playing in the front room. So as it got closer to evening, though, Arthur asked his father, Charlie, if he could borrow some ammunition because he was out of it. Charlie said no, because he might go hunting later that night. And then that's when he told his father that he and Sanders would probably walk to Germantown to go get some ammunition themselves, and then Charlie told him that was probably a good idea. So they headed out, and at this time, Carrie and Maybelle, who said that they were headed to their aunt and uncle's house, decided to go ahead and head there. So little did they know that someone with a gun was waiting for them behind their tobacco farm. Barn, not farm, sorry, barn. At very close range, Carrie, who was 12 at the time, was shot through the hand to her head as she tried to shield herself. Maybelle, who was only 7, ran for her life but was shot in the back and killed. It destroyed a part of her lung and she was shot by a 12-gauge shotgun, whereas Carrie was shot by a rifle. While they were still alive, they were both beaten by a 2x4 piece of wood until they died. But their faces were left unharmed. They had both seen their killer before they died, and they looked into the eyes of their own father. He then drug them into the barn where he placed a stone under their heads, crossed their arms, and closed their eyes. He then locked up, went back to the house where he found Fanny on the porch, gathering firewood for the stove. She must have noticed his gun because she was shot in the back as though she was running away. And it caused half of her heart to be ripped apart. She was drugged through the front door where Marie saw her and ran over to her crying and sobbing near the body. At this point, James, who was 4, and Raymond, who was 2, were outside playing when they ran inside to see what all the commotion was about. Marie, who was 17 at the time, then saw her father had the gun and ran over to the fireplace, possibly to grab the poker, like to defend herself, but he shot her at such close range that her neck snapped and she fell headfirst into the fireplace. A friend of James and Raymond, who was playing outside with them, came inside too, and he said you could see a hole in her back. It was so big that you could see through it. He looked at Charlie, but Charlie didn't do anything to him. So, like, the friend, he didn't do anything to. So the friend ran out the door. He was like,
I ain't staying here.
Yeah. He peaced out. So James and Raymond went to hide. James went under the trundle bed while Raymond went under the kitchen stove, but Charlie wasn't done with Marie yet. He wanted to make sure she was dead, so he hit her with the butt of his gun. But this made the gun jam, so he then pulled Raymond from his hiding place, and he beat him with the gun as well because it was jammed. And James, who was attempting to flee, had the same done to him. Mary Lou, who was only 4 months old, was crying in her crib, and Charlie went over and he did the same thing to her. He then went and got a pillow from him and his wife's bed and put it under his wife's head, got one for Marie, put it under her head, and he was trying to lay her down when he slipped in her blood and soaked the back of his coat. But he put a pillow under her head as well and moved James next to her with a pillow under his head. Then put a pillow under Raymond but didn't move him. He left him under the stove. It was thought that that was because he knew that he didn't have much time and that he needed to just get out of there. So he didn't mess with moving Raymond. What he didn't know was that his brother was about to come over to wish them all a Merry Christmas. It was an unplanned little Christmas visit, and when he pulled up, he noticed that it was eerily quiet, and instead of wishing them a Merry Christmas, he found a crime scene. He went to get the police immediately, and once the police found who was inside the house, they knew they needed to find Arthur and Charlie, who went to get ammunition, because they weren't among the bodies, so they were like, Where are they, you know? And one of the eyewitnesses of all of this ran into a convenience store and was shouting to the whole place that the Lawson family had been murdered. And little did he know, Arthur was inside of that store because that's where him and Sanders were buying ammunition. He said that that wasn't possible, that he was just with his family, and he began to, you know, run back to his house. Once he got there, his uncle had to hold him back because all he could see was his mother's feet outside of the front door. Oh, I know, that no. Part is so sad. But they weren't going to let him in. I mean, obviously, you know, they weren't going to let him see all of that. So while they were all gathered around, the police were investigating inside, and Charlie's dogs ran up from the woods near the house up to them. And then all of a sudden, a gunshot rang out, and an officer followed by Arthur ran towards the sound. They found Charlie's body down by the trees in the snow, where there were footprints all around the tree like he had been pacing, and there were two letters. One that began with, "No one's to blame but," and another said, "Troubles can cause." It was thought that he didn't finish either note because he wasn't expecting to have to do it so soon. He was contemplating, which is why he was pacing. But when his dog started barking and ran that way, he knew, like, the police would find him soon enough, so he just decided to take his life early. So at the family's funeral, hundreds gathered, mostly tourists who had heard of the tragedy. They all wanted to know why someone would do this to their own family. Some believed it had something to do with the injury he sustained a few months before this entire tragedy. He was farming when he was hit in the head with an axe accidentally. So when it got stuck on something, he had, like, pulled it out. Mm-hmm. And it hit him in the face, making his forehead bleed profusely. And he had half a face that was bruised for weeks.
Ow.
He didn't lose consciousness, so the doctor thought everything was okay. but began getting very terrible headaches after that. And his behavior sort of changed. He was in town after that, selling a plant, when a man accidentally hit his leg. He yelled at him, and the man came back and did it again, and he attacked him, saying that he would kill him. The only reason he stopped and didn't keep attacking this man was because the man brought out a switchblade and stabbed him twice. He also had trouble falling asleep after that, and Fanny would often wake up and hear him crying uncontrollably in the middle of the night. So one night, as she put Mary Lou down for bed, he came up to her kneeling and asked her if he was a good husband and if he had ever made her unhappy. She said no, he was a great husband, but he was crying, telling her he needed to tell her something, but just couldn't. He also began to get very obsessive over guns and making sure they were working, but after the murders and his suicide, they decided to do an autopsy of his brain to make sure that everything was okay. And in the autopsy, they found no abnormalities, which for some people disproves that theory that it had to do with the accident. Some say that the family witnessed an organized crime, which was why they were all murdered, to silence them. But not a lot of evidence points to that theory, like, whatsoever. So a few weeks after the murders, Charlie's brother actually opened their house up. He opened the murder scene up to tourists, charging 25 cents to enter because, like, people were doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. They were just breaking in, so he was like, well, I better, you know.
Might as well
make money off of it. So Charlie's brother did that, and he actually, this was really kind of him. He sent the money that they made from that, he would send it to Arthur, the remaining boy. Yeah. So I thought that was really sweet of him to do. So Arthur grew up to marry a woman named Nina, and he had four children, and he went by Buck for the rest of his life. Only 16 years after the murders, when he was around 32, he died in a motorcycle accident.
Aww.
Yeah. The Lawson murders were technically solved, but no real motive was ever found. Until 1990.
Ooh.
A book called White Christmas, Bloody Christmas was published, and in it, it talked about these murders, and they'd interviewed a few of the family members. But in the end, they wrote that they were not sure anybody would ever know why Charlie murdered his family. So a cousin of the Lawson family read that, and guilt overwhelmed them because they had a secret that they'd been keeping for over 60 years. Her name was Stella Lawson Bowles, and she came forward saying that she had overheard her family talking at the funeral, saying that Fanny had confided in them that she had found incest within the family before Christmas. It was said that Marie, the eldest daughter, was pregnant with her own father's baby. And her best friend at the time came forward confirming that, saying that at a sleepover a few weeks before Christmas, Marie had told her that very thing. And the reason Marie felt so comfortable telling her best friend is because her best friend had told her a few years prior that she had been assaulted by her own father as well. So it is thought that that was the real motive. Whether Charlie didn't want to have to deal with the fact that he got his daughter pregnant, or whether Fanny told him that she would leave him because of it. They ended up all being buried in one family grave, even Charlie, which is really strange considering he's the one who murdered everyone. Like, they just buried him with them, even though it's like,
that's
maybe
stupid.
Not. But yeah, that's my case. So I think it's pretty obvious what happened after hearing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because technically, I suppose it's still unsolved, but like, kind of not, though. I mean, I guess they solved it as like he killed everyone, but like the motive. You can't really combat that motive when like there's witnesses saying it happened. It made me really sad, though, like, that it wasn't even just Marie. Like, her friend was also being assaulted.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't even imagine how common that used to be.
They make it sound like, oh, that just happened last, like, you know, just a thing that happens.
And, like, it was like, nothing that they went to the cops about.
Yeah.
You know, that just, it's so weird to me. But it's like, I guess that was just the times, you know? But, yeah, I guess that's just, like, how it was back then, which is really sad. But also, it's like, I'm glad we're past that, I feel like, now a little. I mean, I know it obviously still happens.
Right.
Because there's people, you know, that it happens to, like, all the time. But I feel like hopefully it's not as common because people aren't as out in the middle of nowhere as they used to be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, now there's social media. Like, now I feel like a lot more people than in past can be heard.
Right.
Like,
definitely.
Everybody has a voice now if they have social media. I know not everyone has social media, not everyone has a phone and stuff, but a lot more people do than they did back then. So I think that's definitely a step in the right direction of, like, technically everyone has a voice.
Right. Totally.
some people's voices are heard more than others on the internet, but everybody has a voice. Right. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so that is our cases today. Mine happened on Christmas Day, so Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays. I guess this is the week of Christmas. This will go out on Monday, which will be the week of Christmas.
Ooh,
yeah.
Okay.
So Merry Christmas, everyone. Or Hanukkah already happened. So I hope you guys had a wonderful Hanukkah if you celebrate that. Mm-hmm. If you celebrate Christmas, Merry Christmas. I hope you have a wonderful Christmas coming up. We're doing a sibling Christmas.
Yeah, we are. We're doing a sibling Christmas.
We're excited for that. And we're actually doing that not tomorrow, but this coming Saturday, mm-hmm. which for us will be the weekend before Christmas.
Yes.
And then on Christmas, we're just kind of all hanging out at our separate houses.
Yeah.
But yeah, so super exciting.
What is it? Happy Samhain or something? What's the Christmas? No, Samhain is Halloween. Yule.
Oh, Yule.
Yule, yes.
Like Yuletide Yule greetings. Is one, yes. Yeah. So, all right. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to follow us at Slasher Sisters on Twitter. And we will see you guys or talk to you guys in our next podcast episode. Slasher Sisters out.
Woo.
Jingle out. We should have a Christmas sign off because we had Halloween ones.
Oh.
Angel out.
Angel?
I don't know. Angels we have heard on high. I don't know. It's a Christmas song.
It's a Christmas song?
You don't know that song?
I don't think so.
We definitely sing it in church.
I didn't pay that much attention.
Angels we have heard on high.
Okay, I do know it. I know that part.
You're like, the annoying song. Yes, okay, so Angel out, what's yours? Come up with one really quick on the spot, go. Christmas out.
Christmas out, yeah.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Thank you.